You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanders,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is Benja Lockridge. Thanks for tuning into Author Stories today. We've got a fantastic show coming up for you. As always, go to HankGarner.com where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Spotify, YouTube, anywhere that you like to get your author interviews, you can find us there. I'd like to thank Aaron St. Pierre and Gwen White today for sponsoring this episode with their book, The Fire Thief. She fights to survive, but only white-hot rage will reveal her true power. Remembering the hope of the past helps Stasha endure her bleak present. Blaming herself for her best friend's injury, she brawls and steals to provide in a world run by Faye. But with an arranged marriage approaching, Stasha swipes two silvers in hope of their escape and erupts into a fiery burst of magic. Surprised and confused by power she can't possibly control, Stasha barely has time to register that her friend has been sent off to die. With time running out and no options left, she must put her faith in powerful strangers as they dive into a Fae skirmish for supremacy. Surrounded by dubious allies, her only hope to redeem her past is to mount an attack on an inescapable death camp. As Stasha fights to free her friend, the battle she's faced her whole life is about to become a war. The Fire Thief is the first book in an exhilarating high fantasy series. If you like gutsy heroines, elemental magic, and epic sword and sorcery action, then you'll love New York Times bestselling authors Aaron St. Pierre and Gwen White's Roller Coaster Tale. Buy The Fire Thief to unlock an ancient fae destiny today. Also thanks to Patrice Fitzgerald and the Beyond the Stars Space Opera Anthology series. There are 5 volumes out and a 6th one comes out this summer at the Beyond the Stars Space Opera Anthology series. Each release includes between 10 and 15 short stories, followed by a Q&A with the author. Some of the writers are New York Times and USA Today bestsellers. Some readers are saying, it's a blisteringly good collection. These stories are full of great complex characters, not all of them human. Twists and turns and fantastic world building. Epic space battles, exotic aliens, far-flung planets. 15 fabulous tales that will thrill and surprise you, some chosen from previous Beyond the Stars volumes and some brand new, are in the Best Of collection. Come along as these award-winning authors sweep you along on adventures as broad as the universe and as deep as their imagination. The Beyond the Stars Space Opera Anthology series. Pick it up today. Stay tuned after the show for a special audiobook clip from C. Stephen Manley's Master of Hounds. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am really excited to bring a different kind of show to you. Today, my guest is my good friend in real life, Benja Lockridge, and he is a local filmmaker in my hometown of Meridian, Mississippi. And Benja has a fascinating project that he's been working on for a while, and we're going to give you guys an opportunity to get involved with it if you would like. But because we hold storytelling supreme on this show, and we love to talk to all kinds of storytellers, I asked Benja to come on the show because he has a project he's working on that's near and dear to his heart. Therefore, it's near and dear to our hearts, and wanted to share it with you guys. Before we get into all the specifics of all that, welcome to the show, Benja.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here. Finally, I've been a listener for so long because we're, you know, good friends, and I love what you've been doing, and honored to be here, even though I have never written a single book.
Well, you know, but it's more than books. You know, we talk about the art of storytelling. And we've had songwriters on, we've had, lots and lots of authors. But, you know, there's this innate thing inside all of us that we are created as storytellers. I think there's just something about sharing the stories of our lives that is is something, you know, just innately human about that. So of course we would have a documentary filmmaker on the show. Go ahead.
I completely agree with that notion. Yeah. I've always been a storyteller and, you know, a parent of two kids. And, I mean, you know, it's storytelling is just, it's life for me. And, you know, it's what I do for a living. And of course I'm trying to, create this, true narrative. It's you know, it's not a narrative film, but it's, you know, it's what I do every day anyway. So why not go long form with it and tell a different kind of story?
So before we get into that, we open every show with the same question. And the question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a storyteller?
Oh my gosh, you're going way back. Okay. Well, the first day I realized movies could be made, I wanted to do that. I think my first actual memory was going to see E.T. and realizing there were people that could, you know, go on a set and shoot these things. And, you know, it was just this beautiful tapestry of different talents that would go in there. Costume designers, you know, animatronic people, music people, painters who would do, you know, the storyboarding, and then there's a guy behind the camera who's calling all the shots. And I just thought that was incredibly fascinating. And that's what I wanted to do from day one. I had a dear uncle. I have a dear uncle. He's not gone.
God rest his soul.
sorry, Uncle Sid. I apologize. Who fueled that a lot. I mean, of course my family did, my parents did as well, but my uncle, he did really well for himself. He was in computers and everything, but he also, you know, he did participate in it, but he had a love of movies as well. And every chance he could get, any Christmas or birthday, I would get some kind of book on filmmaking. I remember, you know, he really does well for himself, by the way. he actually lives on the island of Kauai.
Nice.
We don't get to see him much anymore because he's gotten, you know, up in age and it's hard to fly. But now I get books about films that were shot on the island. For example, Jurassic Park was shot there, you know. He was a big part of this and actually helped a little bit financing what we're trying to do now. Just, I guess, to come full circle. As soon as I knew that it was a thing that you could do, I wanted to do it. I wanted to be Steven Spielberg. And I followed him religiously. I just ate up everything I could. You know, I was obsessed with cameras and just trying to figure out how he did that dolly shot with the sheriff in Jaws, you know, trying to, you know, the shot I'm talking about where it's like that. So everybody knows the shot. They call it the vertigo shot. But anyway, just completely obsessed with the guy. And of course I found out, oh, there's other filmmakers. Cause you know, I've got parents who introduced me to Alfred Hitchcock and just all these amazing, you know, filmmakers that have, you know, completely fueled who I am today. So that's what I always wanted to do. I was not, aside from English and history, I was not an academic superstar. So when it came time to go to college, I didn't have the money to, or the funds or the grades to, go to film school. So I did the next best thing. I went to Meridian Community College and I went into broadcasting program so that I could at least get my hands on some, equipment. And I kind of had a notion that things were going in a direction, and I wasn't quite sure how or where exactly, but I had a feeling things were about to change. And, fast forward to 2019, people have better cameras in their palm than I had in college. You know, anyway, I went through that thinking at least I can learn cameras and I can just, you know, get there a different route than the traditional route. And uh, I got my foot in the door at WTOK. Got lots of love for that place because I just learned so much. I made sure I, you know, moved around every room in that station, the studio, you know, the control room. I even did a shift with Master Control, which was just a nightmare, but I did everything. But then I found my way in the newsroom, and John Johnson was the news director back then. Anybody who's lived in Meridian, you know, longer than 15, 20 years knows exactly who I'm talking about. He trusted me with a job. I came in as a videographer, a news videographer was my first job. And then he realized I could write a little, and I just fell in love with telling true stories. It turned out there was enough craziness in the news as there was in fiction. I mean, that's where our fiction comes from anyway. I just absolutely fell in love with it. It's kind of funny. I thought, well, I tried this for a while. I'm going to go into commercials. I'm going to do creative services. So I did that for a while and realized there was more creativity in news than there was in doing commercial work, because I always found myself at the mercy of a client. And, you know, you would get in there, you know, and that's why all the car commercials look the same. You know, they all think they know what's best. And, you know, and I just found myself running back the news. And, of course, I did print for about 9 years, as you know, and we actually did some collaborative work through that. That's how we met, actually. That was fun. Did that for a while, and found myself back in television again, where I'm the news director for a very, very small television station here. I have a maximum capacity of two reporters that work with me, and but it's a lot of fun, and a lot of what I do every single day has gone into what I'm working on today. And I want to do narrative film one day. I'm not closing the book on that, but I'm having fun where I am right now.
Well, speaking of that, I ask people. There have been a lot of guests on the show that have been journalists and have worked in news, and I'm always fascinated by and I ask fiction writers that have had that history before, how working as a reporter, as a journalist, how that honed their storytelling skills, and did they take away any skills from that time as a reporter that helped them in telling stories? Well, now you're working on this documentary film, and we're going to get into why this film is so important and special to you in a minute. But as you're you're crafting a narrative with this documentary. You're telling a story from you're getting from point A to point B, and you're taking us on this emotional journey. So I think you kind of downplay the storytelling element of that a little bit. But your time as a journalist, how has that affected how you see stories and how you look for the elements and the things that are going to connect with a viewing audience?
That's an excellent question. For me, this is not for every journalist. I wasn't in love with being on camera, and I'm still not. Because I'm not as beautiful as I once was. Well, we have the same haircut. You would think that. But, I find that it was easier to pull my ego out of the story. What I mean by that, it's very easily – there's a difference between a journalist and a reporter, okay? A reporter – just says what's going on and looks pretty on the camera. Okay. I see that all the time. A journalist digs deeper. Two people got shot, but you know, why, you know, why did it happen? What's the motivation? It's usually a domestic issue. Nine times out of 10, the people knew each other and there's a story there. And you go deeper, you meet the mother, maybe you meet the father, and you realize, you know, these were people who were a part of a family, part of a unit, who had passion and love and and dreams and aspirations, and then something somehow somewhere happened that made it go south. And seeing the actual story there, that's what journalism has done for me as a storyteller. You know, that's what I teach. You know, when I get, being a small, we're market 190. I know that doesn't mean much to some people, but 190 is almost bottom of the barrel in television markets. For example, New York is market 1. I think Los Angeles is 2. You know, they're big metropolitan areas. And, you know, the benefit of being where we are in a rural community is that there's so much story there. There's so many, you know, I think we have about 50,000 people in Meridian, roughly. I think the last statistic was that we have about 50,000. I said we have at least 50,000 stories available to us at any time.
Right.
You know, and it's just going a little, just try a little harder. Don't just try to get the story done. Don't just say what happened. Don't regurgitate the information that the people there already know. Go deeper. And that requires you to pull yourself out of it, because what that does is when you pull your ego out of it, you have to lean on the interviews. You have to lean on the people talking, and then you realize at the end of the day that it is not your story anymore. It's that person's story that you're trying to tell. And it makes for stronger storytelling when you realize that and you pull yourself away from it. Yes, it's your byline. Yes, you're going to tag it at the end with your name, but it's not your story.
Right.
You're just the vehicle.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so you've been working in news. You've developed a set of skills. You have been telling other people's stories and gotten really good at it. And, you know, you are a face and a voice that's trusted, you know, in our community. And, you know, when you see your name, you know that you're going to get, you know, you're going to get the story behind what's going on. You mentioned your wife, Casey, earlier. You guys have been married for quite a while now. You've started a family. You got these two gorgeous daughters. And one of your daughters, Blake, has some things in her life that you guys have been, meeting head on. And I think throughout your journey there, you found another story that needed to be told. Share with us what it is that's gone on with Blake and how you guys have been challenged with that, and how the idea of bringing awareness to this to the rest of the world has evolved into this project that you're working on now.
Yeah, sure.
That was 18 questions, I know.
I know, and I've got them all secure. So
okay, all right.
Well, we'll see how this goes. well, you know, Blake is our youngest child. She'll be 6 next month, actually. And when she was 2.5, our family physician, who Casey actually worked for, we were noticing some delays in speech at a time when, I mean, you know, at 2.5, you're not expecting a whole lot, but you're expecting something. And because, you know, we had the basis of comparison with Addison, our oldest. You know, she was talking at this point, you know, what's wrong with her? We thought it was a hearing issue at first, so we got that checked out. She did the tubes in her ears and everything with the ENT, and nothing changed, nothing happened, and she wasn't really responding to us, not just audibly, but emotionally. And it was there was a concern, and you know, we brought her to our family physician, and he was looking her over, and he dropped the word autism, that we might need to get her checked out for this. And we said, okay, we'll do it. It'll just be another, you know, check off the list. We never in 1,000 years thought that's what it would be. You know, just the fact that she, you know, some of the symptoms are, they don't make eye contact for very long or at all. You know, and there's some other things that, and honestly, it was in a very early age too. We were very fortunate that, her doctor at the time actually had a nephew. I believe it was a nephew or a niece or someone in his family that was autistic. So he kind of had a leg up on it, even though he wasn't, you know, that wasn't his specialty in that field. He saw some things. And fast track, we found out that she had the condition. She was autistic, you know, that and I think the statistic is that it's 1 out of 59 people that this affects in the world. So she was 1 out of 59.
I think that's a more common number than people are aware of.
It is, and
it's a prevalent condition.
It is. It's you can't cure it. It's not something that you're going to fix. You know, much like Down syndrome or any other kind of mental condition. We went through that whole process and we found out that was what was going on. And naturally, we poured into everything we could to learn about it and every resource available, trying to figure out what we needed to do next. We knew we had caught it early, so we thought, well, maybe this is good. And I do think it was a good thing. I think that was God's grace that we learned early. And so we poured into things, and through all of it, you know, we learned a lot about it. We learned that you couldn't cure it. There's things you can do to help them cope with it. It's a sensory issue for a lot of them, and Blake is certainly that type, where chaotic situations create a lot of anxiety, and our meltdowns were very common. In fact, you know, if she's awake, we're counting on one to happen. Even to this day, something's going to set her off at some point. And it's just usually things that she's – in the way that it was explained to me, it's like you and I, Hank, say we wanted a drink of water out of a water hose, we could kind of control the level and the rate of water, you know, with our thumb, you know, over the spout there, and kind of control how much is, you know, going in our mouth. Well, you know, Blake drinks from a fire hydrant. You know, she breaks it off and she can't control the rate of the water. That's the best way that it's been explained to me, is that she is taking all this information in, and she sometimes often doesn't know what to do with it. And anyway, it was a journey for us. We're Christians. And one of the most frustrating things for us was, I mean, there was a lot of information. There's not a lot of resources in Mississippi to help with this condition. We have, you know, through the last few years, found a lot of help since then, but it took a lot of time and a lot of long list, you know, waits that we had to go through before we got. She has multiple therapies: occupational, behavioral therapy, speech therapy. It's a long list, but you know, and so we did, you know, little by little find those things, and she's getting some help now. But one of the most frustrating things was that, as people of faith, we weren't finding faith answers. We weren't finding it's one of those Job moments, and I'm not equating my life to Job. I mean, I'm not doing that, but it was in that moment,
it's a big,
you know,
thing you, to you.
You wonder why God would allow something like that to happen, you know, and our, you know, ministers, very well-meaning, very wonderful people, and you know, godly people, but they sometimes just didn't have the answers we were looking for, you know, and that was a very frustrating time for us, and a lot of prayer. It was already going on. What am I saying? Did it begin? But you know, we fell on our knees a good bit, and it's just. You know, whenever turmoil strikes, I think even the most anti-God-fearing person falls on their knees at some point. They may not admit it, but I think it happens. But, you know, we kind of poured into that, and we got our answers, and they were pretty stinking remarkable. And that's kind of the angle of the film, in a sense, is that, you know, this is a condition. This is something we have to deal with. But, man, there's beauty on the other side of this. There are things that, you know, initially you're not even considering. There's things that you're not you're just focusing on the problem. And the truth at the end of it is that there was more good than bad going on here.
So you start collecting your experiences through the frustration, the pain.
Yes.
But what you start realizing is that in the midst of all of this, good things are happening, in your family, with Blake, with you and Casey. And, you start realizing, tell me if I'm wrong here, but that the trial and the struggle brings, things that you never could have expected.
Absolutely.
We've dealt with that with, we've had some health challenges with our kids. Our youngest daughter, had a brain tumor a few years
ago. Right.
That was an entire journey.
That's right.
You know, and you, in the beginning, you think that, this is insurmountable. I can't deal with this. This is more than, I've been given more than I can deal with. And,
yes.
And you start realizing that you as a person grow, in ways you never could have imagined. The grace that is there is, you never could have imagined that the blessings would come out of that you never saw. And, you know, we have, Dawn and I have our niece, most days, who was born premature because they were in a head-on car collision. I post photos of her on Facebook all the time.
Right.
We call her Butterbean, being funny. But, she has cerebral palsy. And, in the beginning, these things just seem so insurmountable, but you realize that we have been given so much through this situation, it's crazy the experiences that you gather and the ways that you grow. And, so you guys decided to start telling the story to encourage others what was the idea when this starts coming about that, you know, maybe we should take the skills that we have and mm-hmm. tell the story.
Right. Well, without telling the entire story, the truth at the end of it is that, well, it's always layered. You know, it's never one, you know, thing. For one thing, you know, engaging with Blake. When I go to Addie, my oldest, I can tell her I love her and she gets that. She can process that. She understands what I mean by that. That didn't work for Blake for several years there. We think she understands it now, but, in those early days, words were not enough. I'm a guy who loves words. I know it winds up visual, but it starts in a written word and it becomes, you know, anyway. So I didn't have any words to give her that would help her understand how I felt about her. So what happens is that you have to get on your hands and knees and show her, you know, you have to make it physical. You have to make it tangible for her. And what that did is that it affected every other relationship in my life. You know, that was the thing that it did, is that this is not just for Blake. This is for everybody. You could say, you know, any kind statement you can conjure up, but it means nothing if you can't back it up with action. And I think that's a lot of what this world needs, no matter what you believe in.
Right.
I think, you know, this world needs to understand that point. And on a deeper, more faith point, you know, which is something that I was very much concerned with, was, you know, while I'm asking why God's saying, what's wrong with her condition?
Yeah.
And that's a crazy thing to say, but that's what God does. He says things that are crazy, and then you have to make sense of it. But I did. I made sense of it because, Addie, my oldest, she's dyslexic. She has a problem reading. Who, by the way, she's thriving now. But we had to come at education a different angle. We had to. It wasn't that she was less intelligent than the kid next to her. Her brain was wired a little bit differently, and she just had to learn it differently. She does great. She's a fantastic reader now. She loves doing it. And Blake is very much like that. She's just coming at the world at a different angle, and she's taking things in a different way. And honestly, at this point, I feel like I'm trying to catch up with her instead of her, you know, trying to catch up with us. I feel like we're trying to catch up with her. I honestly think the kid's the smartest person in the room. She may not be able to talk as well as everyone else, but I'm telling you, she's thinking. She's having a lot of thoughts. You know, and so we wanted to tell the story for those reasons, and it definitely goes deeper than what I'm saying here. In our research, one of the first names that came up, you know, we read about different experts in the field of autism, you know, or, you know, the understanding autism. One of the first names that came up, and some people know this name and some people don't. I had no clue who this person was initially, but Dr. Temple Grandin was a name that came up very quickly. I mean, you put autism in Google search, her name pops up pretty quickly on the list. So, you know, you read about it, you find out that she's a professor at Colorado State University. She teaches animal science, you know, just really cool stuff. But she's also autistic. She's I think she's in her 70s now. And then I find out, oh, they made a movie about this woman. Oh, wow. She did a TED Talk. You know, her credentials started stacking up bigger and bigger, and she was just the coolest because she was the first person to articulate what it was like to be inside her head. And the very visual person that she is, you know. The other thing about autism is that if you stack two of them together, they have very different problems. You know, some of them might rhyme a little, some of them are very different. I was very interested in Temple because when I read about her early life, it rhymed a lot with Blake. The difference was we had doctors that had had more information to give us than they had Temple's mother. They wanted to institutionalize her, put her in a room and just forget about her. Her awesome mother, you know, said no to those ideas and got her the help she needed. And my gosh, she's a juggernaut in the community. She's one of the greatest thinkers we have that are living right now. And as soon as I had the notion that I wanted to do this, and believe me, I had to be drug kicking and screaming because I don't want to be any part of the subject, but it had to happen. You know, it was just, it was our story. So it had to happen like that. I told Casey, I said, I want to talk to this woman. I want to talk to her. I want her to be a part of the clinical part of this story, you know, because she has some of the greatest thoughts I've heard about the subject. And we were like, it's not going to happen. I mean, because honestly, when you start reading about her, it's like saying, I want to interview Mick Jagger. You know, that's I want to talk to him. I'm sure he's got time for me. You know, it felt like that in academia. That's the level we're talking about here. And Casey lovingly, you know, I actually kind of put it aside. I said, you know what? It's unrealistic. It's probably not going to happen. Casey actually found her professional number at the college that she teaches at. And I said, you know what the hey, I'll give it a shot. I got an answering service. I remember it was on a Saturday. So I got an operator and I gave her the information as much as I could. And I said, that's the end of it right there. I'm not going to get past the gatekeeper on this one. And I forgot about it. I just went along. I said, it'll still be fine. It'll still be a strong story. People will, you know, respond to it. It'll be fine. And I remember I was at work one day working on our show, trying to get things together. It was crunch time. and I got this random phone number, and I almost disregarded it because it was a Colorado number, and, you know, just like everybody else, I was going, this is a telemarketer, this is someone trying to scam me. And I thought to just go ahead and answer. I was not thinking anything. And if she has a very distinct voice, but it was Temple Grandin on the other side of the line. And said, Mr. Lockridge, I was very interested in your idea, and I would love to talk with you. And I'm just like, and we had a 45-minute conversation because she was asking me all these the questions about Blake, you know, where is she? Does she have any speech yet? You know, just and feeding me. I felt like Neo in the Matrix. She was just like tossing, you know, knowledge into my mind, and I couldn't keep up with the rate of it.
Oh, that's amazing.
And by the end, I knew Kung Fu. But anyway, right. It was just like, it was just mind numbing. She wanted to meet with us, and it was – honestly, it was around this time last year that we did that. We drove all the way to Fort Collins, Colorado, is where CSU is. And it took us 4 days both ways for 1 hour with Temple. And Blake had to go with us. So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But the cool thing was that this is the part you won't see in the film because this was kind of after everything was over. I had an hour with her, and I made it work for as much as I could. And afterwards, she's like, "Well, I want to meet Blake," and I said, "Okay." And you know, she was hooping and hollering down the hallways. I said, "Nobody's getting anything done in this college today." But anyway. But she spent time with her, you know, she watched Casey interact with her, and she encouraged me. She said, what y'all are doing is fantastic. Also had to completely change my journalistic style of questioning, with this woman, cause she's incredibly literal. It was very humbling because I've been doing this for 20 plus years. Thought I had my game on, you know, and I you would ask her a question. She said, "That's too vague. I need more information."
Oh, wow.
You couldn't ask broad questions. You had to be very, very specific with lots of data. Otherwise, she wouldn't answer it. And it's not that she was being rude. She literally couldn't do it. It was like talking to a supercomputer. She said, you couldn't just ask her, you know, what autism is like. You had to ask her, what was it like in high school? What was it like when you were 7? You had to give her more data than she could give you a more thorough answer. And it was just an incredible experience. She's obviously, she'll be in the film. It was just, that was the highlight of our year last year. And just incredibly gracious with her time. I still have her phone number, Hank. I mean, it's just that I get shaky every time I think about it. I'm just,
that's amazing.
You know, and I could call her anytime and just, you know, ask her anything. And she's such a giving individual. And I'm just so glad that she's going to be a part of that. And can't wait to show her what we have. But,
well, you know, talking about, you know, having this person that you look up to and you think is untouchable, and I'll never, you know, get the opportunity to talk with her. And what I've discovered in doing, you know, over 600 episodes of this show is that, most people, if it's within the realm of possibility for them to make time, most people are more than happy to talk with you about what they have going on and to share what they've learned. Some people, you know, scheduling, you just can't make happen, and that's understandable, right, and all that. But most people are more than happy, to give you your time. And especially if you know, approach them in a respectful manner and, you know, show that you just want to, you know, learn more from them and to share their ideas. You know, that's I've had people ask me all the time, well, how did you get, you know, so-and-so? And, well, you just ask them, you know, and you,
yeah,
that's,
yeah.
And, you know, sometimes it's no, but, you know, a lot of times people are more than happy to help.
Right, right. And that's what we learned.
Yeah.
But, just try. You never know what could come out of it. And,
that's right.
It's going to make our story even more rich because of it. And, you know, and she thinks in such a way that we can't possibly think, you know, maybe Blake will one day be able to, you know, speak in such a way. But for now, you know, she was the perfect interview for, you know, that portion of the story.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So it's going to be good. We're doing some insane stuff in the film, things I've never touched before. We're dabbling with animation, and that does not make any kind of sense right now, I know, but it's gotten way bigger than me. And I think that's kind of the point, though.
Yeah.
Is that story does get bigger than you, and that's what you want. You want it to be bigger than life and affect people, you know, in a way. And that's what that's what it's doing right now. We're kind of living the story. We're trying to put this thing together. And of course, then we have to figure out what to do with it. Once we have a final film, what kind of avenues are we going to go down with this thing? And what's the best way to get it in front of as many eyes as possible?
So where's the project now? How deep into it? And, how much more do you have to collect for it?
We are almost there with what I want to call the meat and potatoes of it. The primary interviews are almost there. Casey and I still have to get done with a lot of our stuff. Procrastination is our enemy. And we've got a few more that we have to do, but it's mostly family and friends that deal with it on a daily basis or a weekly basis, whatever it is. People that have impacted her life or have been impacted, which usually is both. But we're getting close. I'm actually in the process of working on a teaser trailer just to kind of get things going. And I hope to unveil what will be a new title, by the way. I know we were talking earlier that we called it Sunshine, and we've been calling it that for a while. We called it that because that was the first song that she sang for us. You Are My Sunshine, that song. I'm not going to sing for you. That's a terrible thing. but it was the first song. It had a lot of meaning back then, but it's been a minute. She's grown a lot. And we think we hopefully have a title that actually has a lot more relevance to it. And I hope to unveil that when we release the teaser for everyone. And
nice.
It's exciting. It's just, you know, it's my first teaser. So I'm trying to, you know, give some gold away without giving away all of it. And
Oh yeah. Find that hook.
Right. Yeah. So it's harder than I thought it would be.
Yeah. But, Well, let's put a practical point on it. This is Autism Awareness Month, and
yes.
What can people do who maybe like me? I mean, I have a cousin who is who's autistic, and grew up around him, and I know a lot about the particulars of his condition. And I had no idea it was as prevalent in our society as it is. Even though I have family members and I'm familiar with it, there's still a lot that I could learn about it. What can people do, to learn more? And, is there a way that people could get involved to, maybe help out in their community in any way? What can people do? We've told them, you know, all about it, and you're sharing your particular story that's also going to shine a light on the greater community. But what can people do to get involved to try to be a helping hand?
I could give you a speech about resources in Mississippi and how long it took us to find these said resources. I think that's I still think that's an issue here. But what I really want to talk about is the fact that. And it sounds kind of cheesy on the surface, but I think it's true. I think awareness is the most important thing that we can have. I was an idiot before I had a child with autism. My knowledge of autism came from movies, and I thought, well, the kid will be really good at chess. You know, that's not what we're talking. Yeah, that's not what we're talking about here. And just even if you don't, because this film is also about educating people who don't encounter. I'll tell you, I was the father, you know, when going through Walmart or some kind of department store that heard a kid screaming bloody murder in the store, you know, and he was old enough to know better in my head. And wondering why the parent doesn't do something to discipline the kid, you know, to stop this from happening. Well, now I'm the guy that has the kid that's doing that. And I believe in discipline, but it's because she cannot help it. She can't contain it. It's the only thing that she can do to find a release is to melt down at this point in time. You know, eventually she'll learn to cope with those things. But right now, I hear it in stores now. If I ever, you know, have the opportunity to be alone in the store, I hear it and I, you know, I pause and go, what if, you know, what if that's a person that's really dealing with something that I don't know about. And, I think that's the best thing that we can do is educate ourselves about things that we don't know about. I mean, let's be readers again, guys. Let's actually crack open books. Let's actually read some stuff and learn about the community around us, because it does affect a lot of people. And, yeah. And you know, I'll tell you, a great first study on autism is the most entertaining one. It's watch the Temple Grandin movie. I honestly thought it was a great primer for people to understand the condition. And it's an incredibly entertaining film on top of it. So if there are people in the listening audience who don't necessarily want to do the work, then do it leisurely. You know, watch that film and learn something. And I just think just watching that, honestly, would do so much to have a group of people that understand what's going on. And yeah, yeah, that's
I'll hunt down a link for that and put it in the show notes, and where folks can have that easy resource.
Right. Last I checked it, I think you can watch it on Amazon Prime. Okay. If you're, you know, you're a member, you can pay for it, but I think if you're a member, it's, you know, I think it's included. Right. I checked. So maybe that's hopefully still true. Nice. But, it's a fantastic film though. Claire Danes plays her in the movie, and it's a shame it wasn't a theatrical release, because she should have got an Oscar for it. It was just absolutely phenomenal. You forget it's her.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's amazing. So,
well, I know you guys also have a running crowdfunding project, and we were talking earlier. Right now, you guys have what you need, but there are always ongoing costs with getting a production like this going, and things pop up in licensing and all of that stuff. So we're going to put a link to that in the show notes as well. If someone would like to help out and to get the story out there, we'll do that. And, you guys also have, a Facebook page, Sunshine the Movie.
Yes.
We'll put a link there. Although the name's going to change, but right now that's where you can find
it. That's how you find us. Right. And you're absolutely correct. We've gotten to a point where, we know that there's going to be an additional cost. We just don't know what it is yet. So we're not asking until we know what that is. We've drained every penny that we had, but we are absolutely at a point where I know that, and we were talking earlier about music licensing and how much of a nightmare that's been. And I know that there will be a price tag on that. I just don't know what it is yet, because I haven't gotten to that point yet. Gotcha. So, so we'll make those announcements when it comes. We've done some t-shirt sales before, so that you can actually have something for your donations and stuff. We don't like to just, we don't like handouts. We're not that kind of people. So I mean, you get to us, you get a t-shirt. You know, we've done that before, and I imagine if the price tag gets pretty high, we'll do something similar again. We'll absolutely have those announcements. We do Facebook Lives here and there. I'm probably going to increase the rate of that, just to it's fun. It's a fun conversation, because people get involved and they start asking a lot of questions about it, and it starts a wonderful conversation about autism and what it is, and like you asked, how you can help.
Yeah. Well, I know folks out there are going to want to help and going to want to be a part of this story. And it's not often that we have a story unfolding that we can be a part of. And I think we need to give people an opportunity to be a part of it if they choose to do so. So we're going to give them that opportunity.
Right. I appreciate it. You know, and obviously the story, we've come to the realization that we're very early in our journey, and that and even when we get done with this film, it's going to, our story is going to continue and evolve and get bigger and bigger and bigger. We're trying to decide what to do with that. We were thinking maybe a potential YouTube channel later, just to kind of continue the narrative, so to speak. And but that's in the distance. I got to get through this first. But
there you go. Well, we're going to put links to it in the show notes. Benja, I love hanging out with you. Anytime.
Yes.
Thanks for coming on to share your story and the story of the story you're telling. We're going to send everybody to see you, and looking forward to that teaser trailer and to the upcoming movie.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the show. Go to HankGarter.com to subscribe. Now stay tuned for a special audiobook clip from Master of Hounds from C. Stephen Manley.
He met Clint's eyes for the first time, and for an instant they flared with a dark violet light, like something you'd see lighting up fluorescent paints in a nightclub. Clint gasped suddenly, despite himself, and took another few steps back. He turned to run, blood bag scraping along behind him, when a chorus of howls from the floors below brought him up short. He stopped and looked around, fighting hard to keep his fear under control. "Be glad you parked near the top," the man said. "I told my hounds to start at the bottom and work their way up, while I came in from above. If you'd encountered them instead of me, you'd be in pieces by now." Clint was sure he could make it to either the stairwell that would lead him back inside or the elevator that would take him down to the garage's ground level. He'd have to stop at either, though, whether to try and pull a door open or wait for the elevator car. He glanced to the side as flashes of police strobes started lighting up the night beyond the parking deck, and sirens grew louder. He heard the distant chop-chop of a helicopter's rotors. "Don't get your hopes up," the man said. "All the pickmen are dead, and my hounds will make short work of the police. You're trapped, son. Face it like a man." Clint thought it over for a second before he realized that the man was right. No matter which way he went, he would get run down before he had a chance to get clear. There was no way out, and that meant there was only one thing left to do. He drew in a deep breath, knelt, and placed the patient on the floor as gently as he could. Fear-driven breath hissed around his teeth as he turned and faced the man in the stained suit. "I'm not your son," he said, meeting the other's eyes and planting his feet. The man's eyebrows rose in surprise. "Excuse me?" Clint swallowed hard. "You heard me, Slim. I'm not your son, and if you're looking to hurt this guy, well, we have a problem if that's the case." The man's eyes had grown wide with disbelief as Clint had been talking. After a moment, a wide smile crossed his face. "Let me make sure I understand," he said, holding up a hand for Clint to wait. "You've met my hounds. You just saw me throw that female around like she was a lawn dart, and now you're standing between me and my prey, even though it's obvious from your face that you have no earthly idea what I am or what you're actually facing. Have I got that all right?" Clint swallowed again. His mouth was as dry as a desert wind. "I think that about sums it up." The dark light flared through the man's eyes again, and tiny arcs of the same colored electricity danced over his hands. "Give me the pickmen," the man said, his voice suddenly more animal than man. Clint's stomach tightened as his guts went cold. For just an instant, he almost ran, but the moment passed, and he shifted his hands and feet into a defensive stance. He forced himself to hold the other man's blacklight stare as he shook his head. Suddenly, the lights were gone from the man's eyes as though they'd never been there. "Really?" he said. "Usually that little display sends you humans running like rabbits. It's been decades since anyone stood up to me like this. Why would you? You must recognize that I can kill you as easy as sliding off a horse. Why would you risk that for someone you've just met? He can't possibly be anything to you. He's my patient, Clint said, forcing the words past the lump in his throat. He's mine to look after until he's well. That, and I made a promise. Besides, you said it yourself. I'm boxed in here. If this is where I go out, then I'm sure as hell not going to do it running. The man studied Clint through narrowed eyes, his smile dropping into a thoughtful line. You would die for a promise. Son, that makes you a rarity in today's world. He raised a finger to his lips absently, as though considering his options, and then said, I'll tell you what. Since you've shown some obvious courage, I'll make you a deal. You walk away unmolested by either myself or my hounds. Gone. Free and clear to live out as long a life as you can manage. Only you, though. The Pikmin stays with me. Even Clint was surprised by how fast he replied. No deal, freak show. This man's under my protection. The man with the blacklight eyes shook his head thoughtfully. A rarity indeed, he said. It's very nearly a shame to kill you. The man studied him a moment longer, then shrugged and said, Oh well, omelets and eggs. Energy flared around his hands and he thrust them toward Clint. Clint saw the hands coming up, the dark energy crackling between them. At the same time, though, he felt someone grab his ankle from behind. Warmth, like walking from a cold room into a hot summer day, flooded through him. At the same moment, searing pain seemed to light up his chest and head. For an instant, everything went dark. He felt as though he were being shredded apart from the inside out and pulled into a trillion molecule-sized lines that stretched out into a black forever. He had no throat to scream with, or eyes to weep with, or limbs to defend himself with. For that instant, he was little more than a stain of pain and terror stretched across the world. Then, the instant was over. Clint didn't feel himself fall, didn't feel the concrete bite into his face, didn't hear the sobbing scream that rushed from his throat. In those last instants before the darkness came for him again and his vision was clear, all he saw was his patient rising to his feet and stepping past him.